Thank you. Thank you so much for coming. I really appreciate some of you came here at 6, which is impressive.
I guess you have many fans.
So you don't need fans.
Well.
Interesting interlocutors.
Yeah, maybe was a better way to put it. So I'm presenting you Yannis Varoufakis. He's known for being very good at biking and as a former Minister of Finances of Greece. And he recently created a platform called DM25. And today he will talk about it, you know, what's the idea behind, what's your mission, what we are planning to do, and how he plans to actually democratize Europe and to reform EU institutions. So let's give him applause, I guess, a round of applause.
Good evening. It's wonderful to be on the mountains in the heart of Europe to discuss our very deeply troubled Europe. I'm not in the business of democratizing anything. I'm not in the business personally of doing anything. Europe is too large to be democratized or to be even shifted by 1 millimeter by a few people. It's a major undertaking. But allow me to just... I don't need this. Can you hear me at the back?
No, that's gonna record. But
okay, so I need to do this, or just put it there.
Can we put it here?
It's better.
Okay, I'll pretend to be seen. Yeah. Okay. So that you can see me at the back. Let's cut to the chase. The European Union is disintegrating. It has been disintegrating since 2008, and the reason why it is disintegrating is because its economic structure was created in such a way that it was impossible to withstand the global financial crisis that began in Wall Street. So the first time Europe disintegrated after Wall Street went south, it happened before, remember the 1930s, after 1929. What is remarkable is the similarities between our era and that era. Of course, there are differences, important differences, and we hope that the two episodes end up particularly different. But the similarities are striking, and it will be only at our peril that we neglect to notice those similarities. The main similarity is that in the 1920s in Europe, we had a common currency. It was a gold exchange standard, very similar to the euro. It is as if the euro was modeled on the gold exchange standard. The gold exchange standard was not a single currency, like the euro is, but in a sense, it was a monetary coming together, fixing exchange rates permanently, supposedly, without providing to this monetary union any of the shock absorbers which are necessary during times of crisis. Every time you bind together very different economies by means of a common currency, without what I call a mechanism for recycling surpluses and deficits, which is essential. Germany has it, Austria has it, Greece used to have it, Britain has it, America has it. The European Monetary Union does not have it. And when you don't have this surplus and deficits recycling mechanism, what happens is this. There are two phases. Initially, the creation of such a monetary union is giving an incredible dynamism to the economies that have been bound together. There is optimism, there is a large flow of capital from where it accumulates, the surplus countries, from the countries with the current account surplus. There is a lot of capital there. It floods to the deficit regions. This allows demand for goods and services in the deficit regions to spike. Imports from the surplus countries to the deficit countries go up. That gives a semblance of growth both in the surplus and the deficit countries, and everybody's celebrating what a great idea it was. I, perhaps disingenuously, but nevertheless, I can't help myself, I use a parallel of creating such a monetary union with invading Russia. The beginning is always splendid. Remember Napoleon, Hitler, the first few weeks are weeks of triumph until the armies get bogged down in the snow. Grim winter descends upon them, and then it all ends up with blood on the snow. This is what happens with the monetary union, which lacks the shock absorbers necessary to absorb the inevitable shocks that the same monetary union creates. And especially when the European monetary union area that we created relied entirely on the United States of America. For what? Not for oil or energy, not for even inspiration. No, it relied on the United States for one thing: to generate sufficient aggregate demand globally so that Germany, Holland, and the other surplus countries could retain their increasing current account surplus, to create the demand outside the Eurozone, which was necessary in order to stabilize and give the semblance of the grand success that the Eurozone was supposed to be at the beginning. In 2008, the American economy lost the capacity to create and to boost aggregate demand worldwide. It just lost it. Wall Street was playing that role. It was recycling global capital. It was creating its own private money, you know, the story with the derivatives and so on and so forth. So it was doing two things: recycling everybody else's capital, German capital, Japanese capital, Dutch capital, Saudi capital, and of course, increasingly, Chinese capital. It was recycling it, helping effectively pay for the American current account deficit. The American current account deficit was keeping German factories busy by generating the effective demand for Mercedes-Benzes and so on and so forth. The hubris of Wall Street was such that once its leverage ratios reached tremendous levels, all it took was some random event for this bubble to burst. The bubble burst, and the American economy, and in particular Wall Street, lost its capacity to do this surplus recycling. We were saved, and when I say we, I mean, I'm talking about the global economy, we were saved by two things. Firstly, that we had in the Fed Ben Bernanke, and we had, in other words, somebody who had actually studied the Great Depression of the 1930s. That was his PhD thesis. He understood that when the bubble of that immensity bursts, public money must replace the toxic, burnt-down private money of Wall Street bankers. That was one important difference. The reason why we didn't go straight into the Great Depression like in 1929, in 1930, was Ben Bernanke and the Bank of England to some extent. The European Central Bank distinguished itself by being the most idiotic central bank under the worst central banker to have walked on the planet, Jean-Claude Trichet, who should have been actually prosecuted for the levels of his stupidity in the way that he responded. No, I'm serious about it.
Poland has been persecuted.
Just in case I have not made my point forcefully enough, Jean-Claude Trichet should not be allowed to circulate around us without hanging his head in shame. He increased interest rates in July 2008, right? That's it. I don't need to say anything more. I will say something.
Well,
he increased them again in the spring of 2011, okay? This is a typical example of what you can't do. Anyway, so to cut a very long story short, the moment global demand collapsed from Wall Street, it was central banks that refloated the banking system, the financial system, and prevented a catastrophe like that of Greece, because Greece did experience the Great Depression. The rest of Europe did not. And the second, of course, factor was China. China paid us a major service. They provided us with a rebalancing factor, which we have not acknowledged as the West yet. Effectively, they borrowed all that money and they created their own credit in order to refloat the level of aggregate demand to levels that allowed countries like Germany not to go down the drain in the way that they would have done without China. But this is the reason why global capitalism did not just collapse. the Fed and China. But that was not enough in order to allow for the European economy, which was punctuated by a series of design, architectural design errors, from going into a debt deflationary spiral. And the debt deflationary spiral has been with us since 2008. It's never gone away, not for one moment, not for 1 week. And this crisis manifests itself in different ways, in different places. So in Greece, it's the Great Depression, the most indebted and bankrupt state. In order to take a hit on behalf of the rest of the Eurozone, which was not ready to acknowledge what had happened to the French and the German banks, effectively decided in its wisdom to grant Greece the largest loan in human history, in absolute terms, to the most bankrupt state, on condition that it would shrink its economy by 30%. In other words, guaranteeing that the loans would never be paid back. And then carrying on the extending and the pretending policies which have rendered Greece a failed state, and the Greek society, a society in a humanitarian kind of meltdown.
I heard recently you talked and you compared, you know, US and the state of Delaware will, you know, fail when it's not the fault of state of Delaware, but of United States. And you made a comparison with Greece, that it's not the failure of Greece that it's failed, but the failure of EU. Maybe you want to comment on that.
Very briefly. That Greece is a highly problematic social economy, there's no doubt. I can give you long lectures on what's wrong with Greece. There's so much, I don't know where to begin. But this is your point. Imagine that the great state of Delaware in the United States was in deep trouble, and it threatened the existence of the United States of America for 8 years running. Then I submit to you that there would be something wrong not with the state of Delaware, but with the United States of America. Delaware is not large enough to damage the United States. Greece is not large enough to explain why it's been in the front lines, in the headlines for so long. It's simply indicative of something that is particularly wrong with the design of the European Union. So I mentioned the manifestation of the crisis, of the global crisis in Greece, but let's now go to Austria, since we're here, to Germany.
Sure.
What is the manifestation of the crisis here? It's negative interest rates. The fact that people pay Dr. Wolfgang Schäuble for the right to give him money for free. That the fact that he's not taking it is another matter. But there are investors out there who are insisting on lending to states, not just the German state, the Dutch state, the Japanese state, and so on and so forth, at negative interest rates. That should really ring an alarm bell. What does it mean to say we have negative interest rates, that the price of credit is negative? So in other words, the price of money is negative. So what has suddenly happened? We've gone from a situation where, you know, the Beatles had to sing that money can't buy me love, to admitting as a global capitalist world that money is a bad, because only bad things have negative prices. It's like toxic waste, right? You pay somebody to get rid of it. Negative interest rates means that you are paying somebody to get rid of your money or to take it away from you. So if this sounds paradoxical, it is because it is paradoxical. But it's not really a paradox. If you look carefully at it, it is a very simple result of huge supply of money, idle savings. In the Eurozone at the moment, we have about 4.5 trillion of money that's sitting there doing nothing in bank accounts. Money which is saved, but which no one wants to borrow, to invest. Now, the whole point about capitalism is that there are savers who save, and there are investors who take those savings and invest them into productive activities that produce the incomes that pay the interest. So if the investors are too paralyzed by fear because of the debt deflationary self-perpetuating crisis to borrow the money that the savers are saving, then we are in that self-perpetuating debt deflationary crisis. The problem is that not only do we have this debt deflationary crisis, but we have a monetary union which has different jurisdictions, fiscal jurisdictions, you all know that. We don't have a fiscal union, and we don't have a banking union. 2 years ago, we proclaimed a banking union in name to deny it in practice. The reason why we're talking about the Italian banks at the moment is because we don't have a banking union. If we had a banking union, we would not be talking about Italian banks because, you know why? There would be no such thing. In the United States, there's no such thing as Californian banks. There are American banks. If a bank in Nevada goes under, it's the FDIC that will bail out from Washington. It won't be the state government of Nevada that will have to legislate and will have to bail in or to decide or not to decide to bail in investors. So we don't have a banking union. So we have all these jurisdictions, different fiscal jurisdictions, different banking jurisdictions, and a debt inflationary cycle. Allow me just so that we can...
Yeah, sure.
Because I don't want this to be a lecture. I want us to start talking, chatting. Allow me to put forward to you a hypothesis. It's a theorem, not an axiom. I'm going to try to defend it in the process of our discussion, but this is the theorem, if you want. It's the line with which I started. Europe is disintegrating under the weight of this debt deflationary cycle. We, in my estimation, are finding ourselves in a political cyclone, which is very similar to that of the 1930s, because the moment the common currency area pushes countries, different countries in different ways, into this debt deflationary crisis, the first thing that happens at the political level is a massive rise of racism and xenophobia. Scapegoating in the 1920s and 1930s, it was a particular race of people that were targeted, the Jews. Now we have a variety of others that are being targeted. And proud nations start pointing accusatory fingers at one another. The Germans hating the Greeks hating the Germans, everybody hating the French. The British wanting to have nothing to do with any one of us. So why is the disintegration of Europe a problem, of the European Union a problem? If I'm right, and I wrote a whole book about it recently, that it was put together in an appalling manner. It started off not as a political union, but it started off as a cartel of heavy industry, which then... You remember what the first name was? The European Community for Coal and Steel. It was a cartel, like OPEC. That's what the EU's origins were. So if you start a political union as a cartel of heavy industries, and then you extend it by co-opting the French farmers through something called the Common Agricultural Policy, the purpose of which was to bribe French farmers to accept the industrialist union. And then on top of that, once the global currency, which was a Bretton Woods system, the dollar, we were in the dollar zone. Right? In the 1950s and 60s, the European Union had the dollar. We called it the franc, the mark, and so on, but the exchange rate was fixed with the dollar under Bretton Woods. We were in the dollar zone. In 1971, it was 15th of August, 1971, Richard Nixon, the president then, announced that we are what I call Eurexit. That is, Europe is jettisoned from the dollar zone. We were thrown out, in other words. Out you go. We were expelled. What Wolfgang Schäuble was threatening me with Greece, President Nixon did it with the whole of the European continent. And since then, we've been trying to create our own Bretton Woods, our own common currency. It was the snake, the Werner Report, then it was the European monetary system, then it was the European exchange rate mechanism. All those were dismal failures until we locked everything in into the euro. And now the euro is crumbling for the same reasons that the gold exchange standard was crumbling in the 1930s, yielding exactly the same political process of disintegration with Le Pen, with the AfD, with Golden Dawn, with even left-wing colleagues of mine who are arguing that, okay, the European Union was a big mistake. Let's go back to the nation state. So what is Diem about?
Yeah, that's what I wanted to ask you. It's actually recently created, Diem25. And can you tell us who actually came up with the idea, how you found your team? I saw you have 10 men and 6 women featured on your website as members.
Oh, have a lot more. A lot of more
at
women.
That's not like what I saw featured on the website. Can you tell us the story?
We are a feminist organization and gender balance is one of our achievements, I think.
I appreciate that. We do appreciate that.
If you look at the Berlin event, for instance, it was exactly 50-50. But anyway, that's not the issue. The issue is this. If this was 1930, what would our duty as Europeans be? My answer to that is, if this was 1930, exactly 1930, 1930, and we were here, I think that we should be very worried about the debt deflationary cycle. We should be very worried about the way that this is causing centrifugal forces that are tearing us apart as Europeans, and very worried about the populists, racists, xenophobes, and crypto-fascists, or actually openly fascists back then, who wanted to take advantage and did take advantage of that set of circumstances in order to impose their vulgar, misanthropic rule upon Europe and drag us into an abyss. I hope it won't happen this time. But I think that we live in a postmodern 1930 moment when we, as the European Democrats, must do that which we failed to do, or our predecessors failed to do in 1930, to band together across political ideologies, across national identities, across even different conceptions of the good society, whether we're liberals, progressive conservatives, left-wingers, whatever we are, Greens, whatever we might be, because the disintegration of Europe is going to have, let's be very practical, an immense human cost. I loathe the euro. The euro was extremely badly constructed. Do I want to see it go? No. Why not? If I think that the euro was such a bad idea and such a bad architecture and design, why don't I want to go back to our national currency? Let me tell you why. Allow me just very briefly to narrate what will happen if the euro starts leaving us. What will happen is that the first country that actually would go from the euro is not Greece, it's Germany. And the reason is that the moment Mrs. Merkel, probably the most pragmatic and capable politician around in Europe, at least in government, once she sees that Italy is gone, that Italy cannot be kept in the euro, she will immediately realize that the liabilities of the European system of central banks will simply not be borne by, cannot be borne and should not be borne by Germany. She will realize, or somebody will tell her, that France will not be able to be sustained within the euro if Italy is out. And Germany is the only country, really, that can leave the euro without too much hardship. Because the moment you announce that Germany is leaving, there's going to be a flood of capital going into Frankfurt. Bank accounts from Italy, Spain, France, even from Japan will empty, and all that money will come to Frankfurt banks in anticipation of the appreciation of the new German currency compared to the euro. So there will be a disaster for deficit countries and actually not so bad. It won't be good. I'm not saying that it is in the interest of Germany. But what I'm saying is that Germany will not be turned into a basket case overnight, whereas France will. Okay? And but this will be a long-term, medium-term, long-term terrible for Germany too. Because think of Switzerland, the trouble that the Swiss central bank has to keep the Swiss franc down it will be nothing compared to the trouble that the Bundesbank will have to keep the Deutschmark down. And then immediately, once the Deutschmark starts skyrocketing, which it will, in spite of anything the Bundesbank does, there's going to be a severe drop in German exports to China, to the rest of the world, to the rest of Europe, of course. And suddenly, millions of mini jobs in Germany will be lost. Millions of people who are just struggling to survive while working full-time now in Germany will become unemployed workers. And the same thing is going to spread east of the Rhine and north of the Alps. So you're going to have a deflationary with high unemployment, a very low investment Germanic area, spanning from the Rhine all the way to the Baltics, and the stagflationary Latin Europe with a combination of high inflation and high unemployment. You only need to think of this and ask yourself the question, politically, who's going to benefit from that? Really bad people who are going to recreate animosities between our peoples within countries. It's not the kind of Europe I want to live in. This is why some of us got together and said, all right, the old way of doing politics is kaput, it's finished, it's back. You only have to experience it for a very few hours, not weeks and months, in Brussels and in Frankfurt and in Berlin, to know that the old style of politics is simply gone. Did you read about the great meeting between Merkel, Renzi, and Hollande on the and that aircraft carrier? The Italian aircraft, why does Italy need, forget, on an Italian aircraft carrier, okay, next to Vesuvius, they got together to discuss the future of the European Union after Brexit. And they talked and talked and talked, and what did they come out with? That we need a bit more coordination of our armies, at the defense level, that Renzi can bend the rules of Maastricht, we will look the other way for the next year or so, because there are elections and all that. And what and Hollande is going to lead the war on terror. That's it. That is the limit of sophistication of our European leadership at the moment. I can tell you, I only was in office for 6 months. I went to 16 Eurogroups, and the number of ECOFINs, it was a very tight period. I can assure you, not once did we discuss the architectural design faults of Europe. Not once did we discuss what we need to do to solidify Europe and defend it from the spiral that I was referring to. So if the powers that be won't do it, we need to do it at the grassroots level. It's a highly utopian project. People ask me, do you think there's any chance it will work? My answer is I don't really care. It's worth a try, because I can't think of an alternative. Remember the 1930 moment? If people like us got together in 1930 and asked the question, what do we do to stop the slide into the abyss? It would be very easy to despair and to say, well, there's nothing we can do. I think that was a mistake back then, that they actually never got into the same room to actually have this conversation. So Diem began with this idea of getting together to do two things. Firstly, to create the first movement that is not a federation. It's not that we have Diem Greece, Diem Germany, Diem France, and we have some kind of confederacy of all that, like they do in the European Parliament, which is the European Party of the Left and the European Party of the Democrats and Socialists, the Popular Party. No, we are not. We enter Diem as Europeans. We do not enter it as Greeks, as Germans, as British, as Swiss. We even have Switzerland in it because we do not believe in these phony distinctions. Europe is one continent and we either swim or sink together. So that's if you want, the innovation. It's a genuinely transnational organization. And the second thing we're trying to do is we're trying to organize all our activities around combating the worst enemy of democratic politics in Europe today. And the worst enemy of democratic politics in Europe today is what I call Eurotina. Tina, you're familiar with, there is no alternative, but Eurotina is a particular brand of Tina. The dogma that within the current framework of the European Union, there is nothing much we can do except that which we are doing, which is nothing, which is simply fueling the fire. The only way of busting that dogma of the euro, there is no alternative, is by showing that there is an alternative. And to do it, how? Not by simply getting together and singing all together, there is an alternative, but coming up with specific, modest policies that could be affected, implemented tomorrow under the existing treaties. Because if you start the conversation, yeah, we need to change the treaties. Yeah, okay. Yeah. 28 parliaments, 28 referenda. We will all be dead before it happens. But can there be tweaks and changes, radical changes, but within the existing treaties and institutions that would stop this that deflationary cycle? Our answer is yes, there can be. And we have begun, we started life in February in Berlin this year. And our objective is within the next 18 months to have a fully fledged program. We call it a progressive agenda for Europe, which will have six chapters, the six chapters that our leaders should be devising and coming up with in the European Union summits, but which they're not doing. The nearest they came to was the Five Presidents Report. I don't know whether you're familiar with that. If you haven't read it, don't read it. It's not worth the paper it has been written on. Read it. If you want just another example of the inanity of the European Union institutions, the fact that we have five presidents is not...
They are called a very critical, you know, a crowd, and I believe some of them already
read it. But you won't get any ideas. You have to create the ideas that these people never manage to come around. So this is what we're trying to do. So let me just give you an example and then I'll shut up. One quick example. So we are going to have a major event in Paris, end of February, a three-day event to discuss what we refer to as a European New Deal, which has five chapters. Each chapter will be a major policy initiative, which we're debating now and which will come to fruition. I'll explain how in a second. The chapters very quickly. One concerns currencies, the euro, the relations between the euro and other currencies, the how do we deal with a disintegration of the euro if and when it comes? Because at the moment there is absolutely no plan for that. If Italy tomorrow elects the five-star movement and they have a referendum, and in the meantime Italy drops out of the euro, how do we handle that? There is no plan, I can assure you, there's no plan about this. So this is first currencies and money markets. The second one concerns public debt. How do we rationalize the management of public debt in the eurozone? We're not doing it at the moment. Thirdly, investment, policies for investment, and how to link quantitative easing by our central banks, and that includes the Bank of England and other, and the Swiss Central Bank and so on and so forth in this, and how to link it with the European Investment Bank and green investment programs. The fourth area concerns the green transition. Okay, we decide, let's say that the plan for boosting significantly investment works. What are we going to invest in? Brown technologies, green technologies? How do we channel the investment into startups? How do we make sure that the bureaucracy doesn't take over and we end up with a state failure to add to the private market failure? And lastly, an anti-poverty scheme that would resemble something that the United States has created in the 1940s under the New Deal, and then later the Great Society by LBJ, who did a good thing within the United States, food stamp programs and all that. So the way we're going about this is to say to do it two ways. It's a bit like a Dutch auction, if you permit me this metaphor. On the one hand, we have a committee of experts who are working on these policies, and it's chaired by my good friend and colleague Jamie Galbraith. Joe Stiglitz is going to be contributing, Mariana Mazzucato. I won't give you the list now. So there is a committee that's going to be working, a scientific committee, but at the same time, we're asking for input from our various organizations around Europe so that the two sets of documents sort of converge to the middle, are blended into a green policy paper that will be put to the attendance, to the attendees, I should say, in Paris in February, end of February, and then from that, the final policy is going to be presented. What is the point of all this? By the end of February, by the beginning of March, to say to the Eurogroup, well, you say that there is no alternative to that which we're doing now. To say to Mario Draghi, you say there is no alternative to what you're doing with quantitative easing. Well, how about this? Tell us why you are not pursuing this policy, given yours has failed abysmally. And let them answer. And we shall make sure that all these policies can be implemented within the letter of the same treaties under which the current policies are being implemented. Now, my view is that if we succeed in putting together policy papers through this grassroots and expert committee process to Europeans, and we say to them, Europe is disintegrating, here's something we could do, but they tell us there is no alternative, but they are not explaining to us why our alternative is not being chosen. I think that that consensus and that kind of discussion is going to find political and electoral expression that will help, no guarantees here, stem the spiral which is causing the disintegration of Europe and its descent towards an abyss.
Okay.
So now I'm going to stop talking.
What we will do, we will take 3 questions, and please keep them short. So first 3 volunteers, please raise your hands. Okay. 1, 2. Okay.
Let's keep gender balance as well.
Well, but you'll be the first one, you'll be the second, and no, that's just recording
that's
what
me.
You say.
Okay. So you mean you don't want their words to be recorded?
I guess that would be a bit complicated. But yeah.
Go
first.
So I'd like to ask you, how concretely do you think to act? Because, for example, now, so about your movement, I am scrapping the mailing list and I try to speak about people in Lyon, but there's the problem that there is still a political structure in each country.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe for sure you'll try to speak with that people by now. Why, for example, they have no answer.
What is your question?
So how can you concretely do or try to make a political alternative on that moment with that movement? Because I think they do know what that there is an alternative, but it's not a problem of knowing that it's a problem.
Okay.
And in political pressure, that's the point.
Okay, sure.
Thank you.
The lady there? Yes.
My question is about whether you would recommend Serbia to get into the European Union, giving everything that you said about everything, or not, and that would be the repercussions
Okay.
And the third question was on the back somewhere.
I think it's totally unrelated, but I think what people cannot unrelated. But
feel free to bring the topics up. Yeah.
You were, Yanis, thanks for being here today. It was very insightful. What I would be interested in, because we were talking about, always about the other. You're not talking about Greece. You're maintaining you're upholding a narrative of Greece, of the Greek rite. Not talking about what happened in Greece between the 70s and the 80s and 90s. Lack of taxation, structural corruption, and completely incapable administration. Politicians lying when you were entering the Eurozone.
Yes,
ahead of this. Yeah. There's a good article where you describe how you found the Ministry of Finance once you took over office, that you had to bring your own computer. There's a list of indicators which describes that it's incapable of financing itself from that took out external loans, and it didn't take external loans because they were pressing Greece, because you were relying, funded your society on the basis of credit. But you're not talking about this. You're talking about you maintain this narrative of victims, and you're always pointing at the other. So I think your story you told us tonight is only 50% of what the total story is. So leaving out these 50%, what are the other 50%?
Sure.
And what is the actual root, which I think is the actual root of the Greek crisis? And we can transport that to, we can transport that to Italy, to Spain, to Portugal. It was not as bad as in Greece. The complexity, the potpourri of negative indicators. But there are many of them as well in the economy.
Let me take one more question. Was it you? Yes.
Okay, the very short one is about monetary policy. To put it politely, you said you are not very much in favor of Monsieur Trichet's monetary policy.
Do you know anybody who is?
End of the end.
Are you?
It's about you.
Okay.
On the other side, you mentioned that there are alternatives to what Mr. Draghi is doing now. So I wonder, and these policies are completely opposite. So what should be done now?
Okay, that's good question. All right, I'm getting a bit old, so I'm forgetting. But your question was about how do we create political pressure? Look. I try to answer it, but not in practical terms. If you want in philosophical terms, the worst, and I'll repeat something I said before, the worst enemy of Europe at the moment, given that if I'm right that we are moving straight to the rocks, and nobody's turning the wheel, the worst enemy is that deep down, even those who are critical of our governments and the European Commission and the European Central Bank, deep down. They have bought the argument that there isn't that much we can do. This helplessness. And the reason is similar to your question. Yeah? You said, okay, Mario Draghi, he's an excellent central banker. And you didn't say that, but I'm saying it. In juxtaposition to Trichet in particular. No, but I think he's extremely smart, and he could, even though he strangled my country and me personally, pure asphyxiation in terms of what I call fiscal waterboarding, I have to say that he's an exceptional central banker. And within his remit, he did everything he could to save the Europe. And he went above and beyond the limits that were allowed to him. Okay? But so, you see, if Mario Draghi is such a good central banker, but he can't do more than that, then even critics of the central bank, critics of Europe, think, well, they're doing the best. Nothing can be done differently. Yeah? And that paralyzes me. And then all you have is either acquiescence, acceptance of the terrible status quo, which is not even status quo because it's deteriorating all the time, or populism and the response of, you know, the Brexiters, those who are saying, well, Europe was a bad idea, let's dismantle the European Union. So the answer to your question again is, we need to be able to do that which the right is doing, but in a progressive and humanist way. And what is the right doing? It goes to the north of England and says, the answer is simple. Vote for Brexit and take your country back. This is what Donald Trump says. This simplicity is very powerful. We need to have a simple message. And our simple message is that, look, instead of QE, I'll give you a particular example, which also answers your question. Okay, so Draghi is constrained by the European Union Council to do a particular kind of QE, because QE, let's face it, is violating the charter of the ECB. And he does very well to violate. He found a beautiful euphemism for doing it, but he's violating. So Jens Weidmann, the chairman of the president of the Buddhist Bank, is right. But of course, then you say to Jens, okay, Jens, if Mario didn't do that, we wouldn't have the euro now, would we? And Jens Weidmann's answer is, it's not his job to save the euro. So, of course, okay, if the Buddhist Bank wants to go back to the Deutschmark, there's nothing to discuss beyond that. So let me give you this example that I've been promising. Imagine that the European... imagine a press conference tomorrow morning in Frankfurt or in Brussels with the president of the European Union Council, the president of the European Central Bank, the president of the European Investment Bank, sitting next to one another and announcing the following policy, that the 80 billion that the ECB is printing every month and to buy assets will still be printed, but they will only buy one asset, EIB bonds, European Investment Bank bonds, nothing else. No mortgages, no government debt, nothing, just EIB bonds. And the EIB at the same time gets the green light from the European Union Council. That's why you need the president of the European Union Council next to them. To announce it, to embark upon an investment-led recovery program for Europe, for the whole of Europe, to the tune of 6-7% of euro area GDP, which is going to be funded by EIB bonds, which the ECB will be buying in the secondary market if their yields start spiking. So suddenly you have a partnership between two pillars. At the moment, in Europe, we have one pillar, the European Central Bank. It's the only institution we have. There are no other institutions. Okay, but if the EIB becomes the pillar of growth to supplement the work of the pillar of stability, which is the European Central Bank, the two together create a front against inflation. So you say this to your Italian, you come from Italy, right?
Yes.
To your Italian friends, and you say, look, we could be doing that. And you know what? Mario Draghi would jump at the opportunity to do that. He would love to do this, but he can't do it on his own. He needs the European Union Council to give him the green light to do it, right? And he needs the European Investment Bank to be ready to do it. So you need coordination. So you say this, why don't we, instead of having Matteo Renzi running around like a spoiled child, begging for the right to violate the rules of Maastricht, why isn't he convening a European Union summit? Italy is a large country. Renzi has the right to say, I want the European Union Council to discuss investment and to discuss the combination of investment policy and quantitative easing. That way, you know, if you have this view and you form a network of local government politicians, which is what we're doing with Diem, as you know, Luigi, the Magistris is with us. We're working with the city of Milano and so on and so forth, and with various parties now. Of course, your political terrain's highly fragmented. And you don't just go out on television and say, we're getting together, we're nice people, we're better than the others. No, we have this policy and we want support to pursue this policy. We have this policy on investment. We have this policy on public debt. We have this policy on poverty. We have this policy on banking. And our policies sound much better than the ones that are being implemented today. That is the way to create a surge. Now, how we handle it politically, we have to make it up as we're going along. Your question was second?
Yeah. Yes.
On Serbia.
Serbia.
Look, as a former mathematician, I always like to impress upon people the importance of distinguishing static from dynamic analysis. Yeah? So, In the 1990s, I was arguing against Greece entering the euro. I was right. We should not have entered the euro. And I'll come back to your question about Greece in a minute. But once we're in, the situation is different. By getting out, you're not going to return to where you would have been had you not entered. So my line regarding Iceland, Serbia, all the non-EU countries is, no, do not get in now. Okay? But my line in Britain is don't get out. Let's fix the European Union. Let's stay within the European Union and fight within it to fix it so that then you will have a good cause to come in. So that has, and seven of them coming to the euro. Third question was, what was the third question? That was your question.
Okay. Yes.
Now, it's so easy for me to get going about Greece and to give you a full analysis of all the malignancies of the Greek social economy, the Greek private sector, the Greek state sector. Let me just make it clear to you that I'm not here to defend Greece or the Greeks, either now or historically, by saying that, reminding those who don't know, that the Greek state managed to have an unsustainable debt 4 years before it was created. We, the revolutionaries who rebelled against the Ottoman Empire in the national liberation struggle, were effectively taken over by some very clever spivs from Constantinople, back then Istanbul, Greeks, who were in banking and various other activities. And they became essentially, because they were well-educated, unlike the partisans, who only knew how to fight, to give their lives for the country, they took over the government, the leadership of the fledgling nation. And they went to London. And those of you who know anything about economics, you may have heard of a very important political economist called David Ricardo. Ricardo and his brother were major bankers, landowners, and so on. The Ricardo brothers were the first to lend to the Greek state before the Greek state was created, an unsustainable sum. And since then, we've been in red territory, in terms of, you know, red debt territory. To cut a long story short, Greece never managed to have a serious industrial revolution. The 19th century was a feudal period for Greece, with a tiny little merchant class which was struggling to modernize Greece. The Great War, then the conflict with Turkey, then after that the Second World War, then the Civil War, the dictatorial regimes in the 1950s and 1960s and early 1970s cemented this oligarchic, corrupt social economy. And there was a period of a mini industrial revolution in the 1950s and early 1960s under martial aid. It was very significant by Greek standards and a great source of hope, but that was crushed by the 1973 oil crisis, which pushed energy prices up. And at the same time, in 1974, we started discussions for accession to the European Common Market then, which brought down any degree of support for those industries, protection, and they collapsed. And because we had no social welfare state, governments then simply took the unemployed, and because there was no unemployment benefit, and hired them as people that were guarding trees in the fields. Yeah. So I don't know how much you know about Greece, but let me say something that strikes most people as particularly interesting and paradoxical. Greece was allowed into the European Common Market in 1981. A major reason for being allowed in was we had the lowest level of debt in Europe, private and public. No, seriously. Greeks were poor. The regime was corrupt. It was quite dictatorial. We just entered fascist dictators, but we have the lowest level of debt. Okay. So I'm quite happy to give you a tirade against Greece, but it is irrelevant. Let me tell you why it is irrelevant. Suppose that Kostas Simidis, who was Prime Minister of Greece in 1999, had an epiphany in the middle of the night, had a dream. Let's say that the Holy Spirit descended upon him
and said to him, you must not take Greece into the euro. And imagine that he decided the next morning over breakfast with his wife, we're not getting into the euro, it's a bad idea. Had he done that, we would not be discussing Greece now. You would not be asking me questions about Greece now. Because if you look at the period from 1998, when it was clear that Greece would enter the euro, at least money markets knew it. It was clear. It was clear. It was already signed, sealed, and delivered by late 1998. And you can see that by interest rates. Interest rates a few months before were 15%. At that time, they collapsed to 3%. So the money markets already took it for granted, factored in that we would be in the euro. There is a huge increase in it was a flood of capital coming into Greece from surplus countries in the eurozone. That created Ponzi growth, pyramidic, unsustainable, pseudo-faux growth. We had 5% real GDP rises, 9% nominal GDP rises every year when Germany was growing at 1.3%. And that was because of the flood of money coming from Frankfurt and Paris. Okay? And I can assure you, it wasn't the Greeks just that they were going there saying, please give us money. Deutsche Bank, Finanz Bank, Societe Generale, they had people who had quotas. They were coming to Greece, they were going to Spain, they were going to Ireland, they had quotas. You must lend so many billions within so many months. And if you don't, you're in trouble. This is what I was saying before, the problem with monetarily binding together disparate economies without shock absorbers. Yeah? So if we hadn't entered the eurozone, that money would not have come into Greece because Deutsche Bank would not trust its euros to Greek banks, the Greek state, for a very simple reason, because a deficit country has its currency depreciate all the time. So you think, okay, I'm going to give them Deutsche Mark, or I'm going to give them euros. If they make their money in drachmas, the drachma at some point is going to be depreciated significantly vis-a-vis the euro and the mark, and therefore they will not be able to repay me, so they will be very cautious lending to the Greeks. And therefore, the growth rate of Greece between 1998 and 2008 would be very tepid. Instead of growing like this, we would be growing like that. And then in 2008, when the whole house of cards came down globally, Greece would have had a bad year in 2008, 2009, and then it would be growing again, like Bulgaria. Just like we're not having a discussion about Bulgaria today, we will not be discussing Greece. And because here I came to talk about Europe, and not about Greece, it would be a different lecture. Huh? This is why I don't think it's relevant to talk about Greece. Greece is the canary in the mine for Europe. It's the Delaware. It shouldn't matter. It should not be a systemic issue for the rest of Europe. It's only 3% of the eurozone economy. It should not be an issue. I'm here talking to you as Europeans. If you wanted me to talk to you as a Greek, we'll have another discussion. But let me just finally tell you a true story, which I think completes the answer. You talked about tax evasion. The worst part of in Greece is not tax evasion, it's tax immunity. That people don't even have to pay tax. Those who can don't even have to pay it. Allow me to say something that is controversial, but precisely true. In the 5.5 months I was in the Ministry of Finance, my top priority domestically was to catch those who had evaded, who were immune to paying taxes since 2000. We had created a task force, very small task force, of untouchables, people that I trusted entirely, because corruption is everywhere in the Ministry of Finance, especially in the Ministry of Finance. So a small team, and we had a major, major, major instrument in our hands. I managed to extract from the banks data on every transaction between 2000 and 2014, real-time transaction, which means that in this digital age, all you needed is two or three good programmers to create an algorithm to map out the network, the dynamic network, so that you know every tax file number within with probability 99.9%, how much income they had to have in order to have all the transactions that they did have. And then to compare that to the tax returns,
which you can do algorithmically. Again, you don't need... And the idea was, once we complete this process, to make an announcement. I was going to have a press conference and say, we know what you've done. But we're not going to tell anyone. You have a week that this particular website, web page, you can go there with your tax file number, and you choose how much tax you want to pay in addition to that which you have paid over the last 15 years. And if we think you've paid what we think that you were legally obliged to pay, you'll never hear from us. And we will not know who you are. This will be done completely anonymously. But if you, and we will give you a certificate that for this sum of money, you get immunity from prosecution. Okay? So that was the idea. It's a German model too. It has happened before with a guard list and so on and so forth. Let me tell you what happened. First, I had huge issues. I thought it would be difficult to get the data from the bankers. Yeah? Due to privacy and all that. Now, do you know what the problem was? Getting the tax returns from my ministry. I was a minister of finance. And I could not get the Department of Public Revenues to collaborate with this team to have the tax returns of citizens included in this algorithm. It took me 2.5 months of constant bickering with those people in that department. And the reason why was because that department is semi-autonomous, not controlled by the ministry. It was controlled by the Euro Working Group, by Mr. Thomas Wieser, by the Troika. And the Troika was the worst enemy of our attempt to get these people. Now, in the end, we managed to overcome it. By June the 28th, I had a preliminary report on my desk. We had found 482,000 tax file numbers that had cheated more than 200,000 euros each. For a small country, bankrupt country like Greece, this is majestic. A few days later, I resigned the ministry for reasons that maybe you know, nothing to do with this. 2 days later, I get a telephone call from the secretary, the general secretary of that task force. And he was in tears. He said they are disbanding us. And they were disbanded at the orders of the Euro Working Group. Allow me to make my controversial but precisely true point. The greatest friend of the Greek oligarchs and tax evaders is the Troika. And that is a very sad state of affairs. I think I've answered your question on Mr. Trichet and Mr. Draghi, haven't I?
You have.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
Shall we take more questions?
Of course.
Okay. You, and then... Okay, so far we have 3 questions. You can start. Yes. Yes, it's you.
Thank you for your point on the quantitative easing. It was very interesting for me, because I don't have any background in economics. Background philosophy, and what we do is criticize whatever we can find, including our own theories.
Good.
So I would like to ask you, and that's a bit provocative, to give us why we should give us reasons why we should not build a cycle around the EIB and the EU.
Okay. So you want to argue against my proposal? Happy to do it.
Thank you.
I'll tell you why. Yeah.
thank you. I'm working for Transparency International, and we also work on these economic governance issues. And of course, I mean, I like the big picture analysis, and this is really wonderful. And so it is a bit a moot point to then ask for technicalities and the Eurogroup and so on. But since you were sitting in the Eurogroup, and we indeed have no clue what's going on in the Eurogroup, I was wondering what kind of argument would be used in order to arm twist ministers into actually changing their positions, into agreeing to these things. And do you think that you can do anything to kind of still argue with the Troika, or can you really just do a revolution from the street, or can we still do some lobbyism, some pressure and so on to kind of get the reforms point within the treaties and within the system?
Very good point.
Thank you.
Thank you. You actually mentioned public debt as one of your 5 points. I have a question about this one, precisely prudent fiscal policy and electoral democracy. Well, the point is, regardless of what the believers say, running rogue often, like this whole debt to GDP ratio, at some point it becomes unsustainable. I guess we agree on that.
No.
Okay.
That has already been debunked. You remember that? The 90%? That was empirically unsustainable.
Tendency is still the same, that's what I'm saying. I'm not saying I've run for but like sort of the problem probably death in the first place. And then when you look at some papers about the xenobiogenic consensus, what the general consensus moreover is, it is possible to be fiscally prudent and still be reelected. There's a paper by him on this, like 12 biggest fiscal like prudence examples in OECD countries, and only looks at the whole period of fiscal prudence, but not at the immediate re-election. Yeah. And I had a look at this, and I also read two articles on this. And the interesting point there was, if you just look, last point, at the very first election after this has started.
Where? In which country?
In all these 12.
Okay.
Biggest fiscal prudence examples. In every single country, the government has not been real. So my question to you is, do you think it's feasible to be fiscally prudent and still be realized as a government?
Right. I forgot what the first question was.
I'd like to argue.
Oh, yes. No, look, I hinted at it. One worry I have is the European Investment Bank is a bureaucratic organization. So the great criticism of it is that how do you expect this bureaucratic organization to manage to disperse the investment funding that will be created and supported by the ECB's QE in a way that is efficient, doesn't take too long because the transmission mechanism must be as quick as possible, and which does not render, does not create a great deal of discretionary power in the hands of bureaucrats, because this breeds corruption, as well as a distribution of resources that does not correspond to the potential capacity of those who receive it. So we have to be very careful. And that's why I think that it is important to split any such investment program between large infrastructure programs that the EIB does quite well, has a pretty good track record of this, from venture capital. That we have, you know, in Europe, we have a major problem with venture capital. You only need to compare it with California, Silicon Valley, and so on and so forth. Here we have a banco-centric bureaucratic system for dispersing funds to startups, and this is why we're not doing as well as we should do. So it's important to create a new institution. Already one exists called the European Investment Fund, which is better, potentially better placed to overcome the problem that I am mentioning. Second point was, who was the second one?
The council.
On
lobbyism and how you can, within the treaties and so on, still
look
pressure. And also what Schäuble does as argument in order to amtust people in the Eurogroup.
As you know, since you work on transparency, Diem's first campaign was a transparency campaign. We asked that all Eurogroup meetings are live streamed. Same for all EU summits. It is crucial that citizens in Europe know what their representatives are saying on their behalf. They do know that in parliaments. All our parliaments have transcripts. They are, you can go actually and watch them and listen to them. They are live streamed. They are transmitted in some form. It is important to remember that the European Union summit, ECOFIN, and the Eurogroup are actually creating legislation, which is then only passed, in kind of formal way through parliaments. And it is important that we have this degree of transparency. But coming to the most important part of your question, look, allow me to say something again, controversial, but again, precisely correct, and I can back it up even with recordings. Discussion. I'm not going to say who it was, but somebody very high up in European politics. Okay, very high up. Somebody with power to change things. Yanis, what you're saying is right, but we cannot do it because for me and my political party and my parliament, it has a very large cost because it will give the wrong message to Spain, Italy, and France. Yeah? So you're going to do as I'm telling you. And if you don't, your banks will be closed tomorrow or in 3 days. Yeah? Now, at that point, it's very difficult to have an argument because when you're being told that you're right, but you're going to do as you're told, yeah? At that point, you say either yes or no. It's binary. I said no, and this is why I was not particularly liked. But what is the answer to this? I think it the answer is governmental disobedience within the Eurogroup. I personally, not for one moment did I believe the threats of Grexit. It would never have happened. Vitor Costanzo came out in September, a few months after we were being threatened with Grexit, if we don't do as we're told, and said, oh, no, we didn't never really meant that. It wasn't possible to do it, and it would have been, you know, it was an empty threat, but it was one that my prime minister accepted. Now, I'm not saying that we should kick and scream like spoiled brats and say, oh, we want this. No. But when you tell me that you agree with me, and at the same time that you're not giving me an opportunity to argue this case on its merits in the Eurogroup with live stream, so that our citizens, German citizens, can listen in and make up their own minds as to whether what Varoufakis was saying was bonkers or sensible, yeah? Then at that point, it is my duty as a democratically elected politician and as a Europeanist who honors the notion of European democracy to say, no, you want to shoot me? You want to shut my banks down? Go ahead, do your worst. If enough politicians were prepared to do that, Europe would not be disintegrating and negative interest states would not be destroying German pension funds today. Now, coming to you, is it possible to be fiscally prudent and get re-elected? Yes, it is. Absolutely. It depends on what you mean by fiscal prudence. Yeah? To be running a structural surplus in Greece of 4.5% at the time of a Great Depression is fiscally idiotic. It is not fiscally prudent. My proposal, and this is referring to the one that I was told I was right on, including by the people from the International Monetary Fund, okay, my proposal was very simple. Fiscal prudence in Greece in 2015, when I was in the ministry, now things have changed for the worse, because, you know, when you allow a wound to fester, things get worse. Fiscal prudence in 2015, the spring of 2015, would be to have a target for a small primary surplus, fiscal prudence, of 1 to 1.5%, instead of the ludicrous 3.5% and 4.5% that they were imposing upon us, even though they knew it was unattainable and catastrophic. And at the same time, to do two other things that would help create the circumstances for recovery, create a bad bank for non-performing loans, because we have banks snowed under 52% of non-performing loans in Greece now. You only have to state it to realize that it is unsalvageable. And secondly, a development bank. And my proposal to the German government was to have a Treuhand with a banking license. So instead of a fire sale company, to put all public assets into a publicly owned investment vehicle, which is at an arm's length from the government. I don't want politicians to be meddling with that. I do not want to be private. I do not want this to be politician ruled either. So I'm giving you an example of what I mean by fiscal. If we had done that, if we were, had been allowed to do that, we would have had 6% in the election. So the answer is yes, but it depends on what do you mean by fiscal prudence. Not just having surpluses for without a macroeconomic plan that is modular and whose different components fit together. Was there another one?
Would you like to take more questions?
I'm happy to be here all night.
Cool. Yes. That's good news for us. Yes.
I'm going to ask you somewhat of a more so physical than economic question. And since it's also rather, but then you kind of talked about it. From my perspective, first of all, it's difficult to say youth, because although that is are together in some sense, they're very different in many other ways.
Which?
Is Europe or is the European public educated enough to take shocks like, for example, the refugee wave? Is Europe actually, or are European countries ready for a democratic process or election the way it is? Or could we go back to it?
Well, Europeans have been uniting under different languages and cultures since the 1950s in a rather impressive way. My feeling, especially amongst young people throughout Europe, is that Europeans want to be Europeans. They want to be German, they want to be Greek, they want to be Italian. They will never give up their national identity, but they don't have to give up their national identity. The problem with European politics is the economics. And I never make a distinction between the two, because the two kinds of politics are effectively accomplices of one another. Yeah. But when you have a debt deflationary crisis, the politics fragments. Even within the same country. Even within the same country, you can find, look at Spain with Catalonia. Look at Britain with the Scottish independence drive. Do you think that Scotland would ever think of becoming independent, or the Scots would vote almost 45-46% become independent if they didn't have the complete failure of economic policy in the United Kingdom of the last 40 years? No. The reason why the Scots want out is because they want to be in the Britain of the 1950s and the 1960s, not in the Britain that the Thatcherism created, the Britain of bubbles, the Britain of the southern real estate market bubble of the City of London and so on. So the economics and the politics go together. At the time of economic debt deflation, the politics turns against humanism and against unity. And we all turn against one another, is what I was saying before. This is why it's important to combine political and economic solutions. It is important to proclaim that our problem is not culture. The problem is not one of DNA. To be well, truly, and comprehensively anti-racist. And how do you become anti-racist? By avoiding sentences beginning with the words, the Germans. Or the Greeks, or the French. Within my country...
Or Brussels.
Hmm?
Or Brussels.
Brussels is a city. You can say Brussels. or the people of Brussels. Yes? What I'm saying is this. The degree of disagreement within Greece, within Germany, is greater than the disagreement between the average German and the average Greek. So... any sentence that begins, the Germans are like this, or the Germans don't pay their taxes, work hard, and the Greeks don't, you know? As Hannah Arendt said once, if one German died in Auschwitz defending the Jews or defending democracy, then you can't say that Nazism is a German phenomenon. Yeah? So that's how you begin, a properly Europeanist agenda. And then you build on it with policies that stop, effectively, let's end biblical economics. The eye for the eye, the tooth for the tooth. A gentleman, a friend asked before about, you know, said before that I am presenting Greeks as victims. No, I don't present Greeks as victims. Europeans are victims. We are all victims of a particular architectural design and particular elites, which, for instance, when the whole thing went pear-shaped in 2008, what they did was a cynical transfer of private losses onto the taxpayers' shoulders everywhere in Europe, in Greece, in Slovakia, in Germany, everywhere. And they portrayed that as solidarity with the sinful Greeks. Now, I can tell you that I know many Greeks who are particularly sinful, disgustingly lazy, who have been living beyond their means for decades. They're the ones who are in power, who have been in power for ages, okay? So let's stop thinking in terms of the Greeks, the Germans, and so on and so forth. Who is the victim? We're all victims of a political design and an economic system that Europe deserves better.
You were telling...
Okay, you go, and you're going to be further. Yeah. Yes.
You were telling before that you had this list of all the taxpayers who didn't pay the taxes, right?
Mm.
I mean, this list, who had it, just disappeared, or you...
I'm no longer the Minister of Finance. I'm not going to take it with me, you know, and start persecuting them personally. And also, look, we made sure of anonymity. You see, it's a very dark day when the Minister of Finance has personal data on citizens. So I made sure that none of us in the political team of the ministry had access to that information. I had classifications. I had, okay, so many tax file numbers had a divergence of their actual income or transactions from the declared income of more than 1 million, so many more than 600,000, but I did not have the list of names with me, and I hope that nobody does. Because then, you know, it's a question of liberalism. Who will defend us from those in power?
We'll have a last question,
I hope this is a good question to conclude, but you've spoken a lot about what your plans are for the next couple of months. Could you maybe speak about what do you see as the task of sort of young and left in Europe? What should we be doing, in your opinion? Please.
We have the same task, all of us. You see, this is not, I mean, every generation has this view that it is in crisis. Yeah, and it's probably true. There are crises and crises. You know, in the 1970s, we had the stagflationary crisis. Then we had all sorts of other crises and so on. But this is there are crises and crises. This is one of two global and significant and dangerous crises in the history of the world. The first one was the 1929-1930s one, and the second one is now. And this is why it's absolutely essential that you all get out there and do that which we should all be doing. Building coalitions with Democrats, independently of whether they are left or not. The left must not make the mistake again of thinking that the collapse of capitalism is a great thing because suddenly we're all going to be living in a good socialist society. No, we're going to enter the gulag if this happens. And the leftists will be the first ones to either to enter it or to guard it. The left has a rather dictatorial past, and I'm saying this as a leftist. So build the bridges.
Join the end.
Sorry. This is my wife. No, I can't say, I'm not a salesperson. I can't say join the end.
That's what Trump is getting said in New York himself.
That's right. That's right. So we have it on good authority.
For women.
For women as well.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Yanis. Let's give him a round of applause.